This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Christmas Eve 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to an especially festive Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, there'll be baubles and bells galore when we talk shop with Bloomingdale's VM director about the secrets of Christmas window dressing.
We really look for our windows to really fascinate children, but bring delight to adults as well. So the windows are really for everyone. And our holiday windows are a gift to the guests and people of New York City every year.
Just in time for winter solstice, we pay a visit to Stonehenge to nose around its brand new visitor centre.
It should be evoking a sense of wonder that people built this monument thousands and thousands of years ago. There should be a sense of mystery. I think there always will be a sense of mystery associated with the stones.
And then we head to Vienna for some crafty Christmas shopping.
Most of them, they come not once time, they come two or three times. First look around, and then a second to buy, and then they forgot something and they come once again.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Christmas preparation in the United States is a very serious affair. As soon as the last pieces of Thanksgiving turkeys have been eaten, the trees and lights are installed. In New York City, the glittery windows of big department stores are unveiled in ceremonies that sometimes include live music and shows. Pauline Eiferman met John Klikowski, National Director of Visual Merchandising for Bloomingdale's, in front of the department store's lively holiday windows.
The buzz of the street, the excitement of the holidays is here upon us, and we've got a lot of guests enjoying our windows this year, which we are thrilled about. This was such a pleasure to do the windows this year. It was a lot of fun. We began this project back in April. The whole design process started to take place, and coordinated with our theme for holiday 2013, of all wrapped up in Bloomingdale's, we decided to take a cue from our core principle of Bloomingdale's like no other store in the world, and we developed our window concept of all wrapped up in Bloomingdale's, all wrapped up in the world.
So can you tell me a little bit about how the process starts? You mentioned you started in April. What are the first steps?
Well, we work collaboratively with our marketing department, and our window theme coordinates with our overall company theme for the season. So you know, there's a lot of brainstorming that happens. A lot of ideas are put on the table, and then through a really high energy environment, we nail down one idea that we think is right for the store, right for the season, and right for our customer.
So let's see what you came up with this year.
Okay. You know, and as far as the design, we really look for our windows to really fascinate children, but bring delight to adults as well. So the windows are really for everyone. And our holiday windows are a gift to the guests and people of New York City every year. Our first window is Great Britain. And there's a little humor in the window. And you see Queen Elizabeth shopping. The windows spin. The countries are wrapped up in a box. And there's a little animated humor. And each of the sculpted, iconic buildings from each of the countries are bejeweled by local artisans so that they really are icy and magical and really special. You can take a trip around the world without leaving Lexington Avenue. Up here we see we're in Italy, and there's a great little humor with Rudolph sitting in a gondola in Venice with his Bloomingdale shopping bags as he's just come out of a store shopping for gifts for his favorite reindeers. And here we have Paris, which I think this one is great. I love the animation here in Paris. where we see the Eiffel Tower not only jeweled but outlined in neon. And then our animation is just as you would expect, the Parisian beauty fashion model taking her pink poodles for a walk. And there's her husband or partner rushing behind her with all the packages she's bought for as gifts. But the holiday windows are always timeless. Each window that we've done over the years could be reinstalled today and would be magical. It's that spirit of the holidays, really, that makes the windows special.
And so what is the goal? Is it to show products that you sell, or is it more to show the brands and what you're into this year?
11 months out of the year, we're showing what we sell. But for holiday, it's all about the spirit. And we really wanted to bring the world into the warmth of the holidays. So we wanted to wrap ourselves up in the world and showcase also that, you know, we have things in our store from all over the world. So you don't need to go shopping anywhere else. You can shop the world here at Bloomingdale's.
And can you talk about the team of designers you work with? How many people are actually involved in the process, and how many days does it take to actually put everything up?
We begin the process of sculpting and putting the windows together pretty much in May. The production begins, and it's non-stop through the opening of the windows. We have a team of 7 stylists on our window team, plus our window director here in Medina. And they work on the windows, but for a holiday, we also bring in local artists that assist in the process, because we really want that piece of New York in the window. So we use local people to construct the windows, as well as a fantastic carpentry crew that we have here in-house.
And does the theme from the windows also appear in the rest of the store, or is it exclusively the windows?
So when you, all through the season and also in the holidays, what you feel in the windows is what you're going to, it's an introduction of what you're going to feel when you walk into our stores and you share your shopping experience. Our graphics and our holiday displays all have the iconic gift wrap that's being ripped open to highlight the items that we feel are perfect gifts to buy and give to someone. And so, you know, throughout the store you see our crystal and the jeweling. Now it's a little bit more subtle in the store than it is in the window, but you imagine all of the jewels and the mirrors and the snowflakes of the holiday as you walk in the store, and you're in an environment that's shrouded in glitter and shine.
And so how long does all of this stay up? How long is your holiday season?
We generally are complete with our holiday setup by the first week of November. And then we don't take our holiday windows or interior decor down till after the New Year. We have a lot of guests that come into New York between Christmas and New Year, so we want them to be able to enjoy what they may have missed earlier on in the season.
Sugar plums dance, and reindeer too.
That was Bloomingdale's John Klikowski talking to our Pauline Eiferman. Coming up, we're going to take a short break from the Christmas cheer and speak to the young designer behind DNAD's awards manual for 2013.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Each year, the DNAD Organisation awards prizes to the creative industries, representing designers, agencies, film production companies and more. To the winners, it not only means recognition from experienced practitioners, but also a coveted place in the DNAD annual. Published by Taschen, 2013's annual was this year designed by a member of its very own Graduate Academy, and young blood designer championed by the president of the organisation, Neville Brody. Fleur Isbell joined our producer Aled John to reflect on the challenge of designing the annual.
it was such an amazing opportunity, and I kind of felt very honoured to do it. So there was always that, there's a slight pressure, but at the same time, you know, it was an honour, and I really wanted to make the most of a really good opportunity. You know, I looked about what DNA D do, and, you know, I've been going through the system of the new blood and the Graduate Academy. So for me, DNA D was very close to my heart and something that I really wanted to kind of, you know, do a good job and do it well. You've got the whole world of creativity kind of looking on you, and you've got all these people and all these amazing creatives who are creating things that go in the annual. And I guess I really want to do that justice. And so when I was kind of researching, what resonated was the fact that DNA D are kind of they're a very global agency, and they've kind of, I realised in a sort of, in the last 40, 50 years, there was a real shift from DNA D being very, you know, UK focused to an organisation that's now all around the world.
And yeah, there's 200 countries
exactly,
represented. Yeah.
So there was 50 countries this year represented in, almost 50 countries represented in the annual this year.
Yeah.
And I guess I really wanted to kind of show that kind of, you know, inclusivity of DNA D and really push this idea that they're global and, you know, creativity is for everyone. You look at, you know, a lot of the canon of design has come from quite a Western background, and I kind of wanted to move away from that and kind of really, you know, think ahead and challenge what a book is, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about what it was like when you heard that Neville Brody wanted you to design it.
Yeah.
How did he hear about your work, and how did you put yourself forward? Was it through the graduate scheme?
Well, the details I don't quite know much about.
He's eavesdropping on conversations.
But from what I've heard, basically, because I was so fortunate to go through the DNA D scheme, so I went through the student awards, and then I was the first year to go through the Graduate Academy. And so there was, I think, you know, Neville Brody's, his whole kind of mandate for the year was about pushing creativity for young creatives. And so he really wanted, you know, if you look at the past designers, they're all quite, you know, they're very seasonal designers, you know, high up professionals, had a long time in their career. You know, he wanted that young blood in there. And so, you know, I get this email and it's like, oh, would you be interested?
By the way,
if by any chance, you'd be interested in designing the annual. So I'm absolutely ecstatic. It's like, I was so surprised, because, you know, you just don't expect that to kind of happen at so early on in your career. I was really quite shocked.
It's one of those surprise
and then
shock,
fear, yes, all in one,
excitement mixed up.
Yes,
yeah, because it's a hell of a, I mean, it's a real tome. I don't know how many pages it's over.
Yes,
600
yes,
pages.
Yes, big.
Yeah. So yeah, let's get into detail of how you sort of processed all the information.
Sure.
So How many designers, and it's not just designers, it's agencies and film production companies, all sorts.
Yeah.
How did you get to grips with all of that info, all the images, in it? And then we'll talk about the layout after.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was very fortunate. I had an amazing project manager at DNA D kind of helping manage the sort of organisation and image resourcing, and she had a team there, Jana, so it was so helpful. So that kind of thing, obviously I had to be aware of it, but I didn't actually really have to manage all that kind of information.
Yeah.
But I had about 20 annuals sent to me, and I spent a very long time analysing the structure and how all the images were laid out and different grids and systems for the design.
And you chose which one would be the finished product?
What, in terms of the layout?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I designed the finished layout, yeah.
Okay.
But the actual image layout.
The images you were sent?
Yeah, I was sent. Just to be clear, they get art. So basically, my task was to design the cover, and then to design like the divider pages and the layout of the pages.
Okay.
And then they had art workers to lay out all the images. And
so one thing that really catches your eye when you're leafing through the 600 odd pages is that there are these, I mean, they're kind of Rothko-esque paint strips down the sides of the pages, to the right or to the left. Mm. And let's talk a little bit about that, if we could.
Yeah.
So reading up on the spiel, you use metadata to focus on geolocations, is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And then create this kind of, well, very bright, a lot of the time very vibrant colours, colour schemes on the pages.
Mm.
What's the idea behind it?
Okay, so, you know, I wanted this to represent the world, and then I also wanted to kind of focus exclusively to the countries that were represented this year in the annual. So running through the beginning section of the book are 42 patterns representing each country.
Of the winners?
Yeah, of the winners. So you've got, you know, a country for a pattern for Australia, a pattern for India, a pattern for Great Britain, obviously.
And those patterns on the front cover
and
as well.
And yeah, those, so all 196 patterns are printed on the cover with fluorescent inks. And it's a sort of hidden thing, but the 42 countries represented in this year are spot varnished on the cover. So at the beginning of the section of the book, there's 42 patterns which represent each country. And so I took the data came from the day that the annual, the call of entries was made for this year's awards.
The data being the time, date.
Yeah, so I used the
weather conditions.
Yeah, exactly. So I took all those conditions and also the location. So you'll see that the patterns have a shifting sort of horizon, mm-hmm. which represents the latitude of each country. So for example, Great Britain in the front of the annual has a very high horizon line, whereas Australia, the horizon is right at the bottom. It was quite nice because, you know, there's this shifting horizon line, and this being like the 51st annual,
yeah.
it's, you know, a young designer's been asked to create it. I really wanted to set the mandate for the next 50 years and really push that, almost that shifting horizons was like a metaphor for yeah. the shifting of creativity.
And the, in, well, the internationalism of
yeah,
the
exactly,
trade.
And the fact that it's celebrating digital and technology and the way design's really pushed from quite a closed thing to something now that can incorporate users, and it's a lot more open because of how things have moved on.
How have things moved on in the sense that you talk about championing the way that yeah. DNAD can look towards the next 50 years?
Yeah.
I mean, how are you sort of exemplifying those, that focus?
Right. So for me, I felt like design's really shifted from a very closed to open, how now designs are including the user a lot more. And so I really wanted to champion that inside the annual and for it to reflect what DNAD could do in the future. The fact that there's a very global focus, there's a very digital focus. And yeah, really wanted to portray those shifts in the annual.
And in terms of the process of designing,
yeah.
not just the horizon
yeah.
lines, I'll call them, yeah. the colourful,
yeah.
the fluorescent ink lines. Mm. What challenges did you face?
There was quite a few challenges, I suppose. I mean, this whole idea of reflecting a global theme, you could have gone anywhere, and there yeah. were some crazy ideas flying around the place. So there was, a tracker in the annual, a tracking device. I wanted to turn the book into like a joystick, so it had like sensors in it, so it could, you know, temperature sensor, a light sensor. So it was, there was quite a few crazy ideas. But actually, what I realised was all those ideas are really important, even if they don't happen, because you have to go broad to get to something really good. If I had started at a really low point, I don't think I would have got to this kind of outcome. You know, obviously there's challenges in terms of what limitations you can do with printing, and, you know, this is such a big run and such a big audience and history of towards the annual that you always have to make sure you're always doing that justice and you're always having the end user in mind, not just thinking, oh, it'd be really nice if I did this or it looked like this, but thinking about actually what does a user want to get, what kind of experience do they want to get from flicking through and reading the annual.
In terms of the brief you received then from, yeah. I don't know if it came from Neville directly, yeah. but or Tashan even yeah. perhaps, were you given
yeah, well,
blank so, slate or was it?
Well, Neville, actually this is quite funny because Neville gave me a brief and I found out he didn't give me a brief. So I had a meeting.
This is a brief, but it's not a brief.
Well, yes.
But bear it in mind.
Yes, well, but it was actually fantastic and I'm so glad he gave me this brief because I don't think I would have got to this outcome if he hadn't have given me the brief or the not brief.
So he, it's very confusing.
Yes, well.
Part of briefs and not briefs.
He kind of said, you know what, be open. You know, use this as a jumping board or a platform and, you know, have fun and apply my thinking that I had done in my previous work. And that open thing was such a big word for me because I felt like I could do anything I wanted. And there was no restriction. There was a lot of freedom. And I think that was, for me, that was very rewarding. It's also quite scary because, you know, if you don't have those boundaries, it can be quite hard. But, you know, I really loved the fact that I had this freedom to explore and experiment. And it was a lot of fun, that process of experimenting with things and playing around. It was great.
So. And how long were you given to do that?
What, the whole process?
Yeah,
or?
The whole process from start
to
finish.
Well, the whole thing started in about late February and then it got printed around September. But the whole design, there was sort of deadlines along the way. It wasn't just the cover, as I say. So there was deadlines for the working pages and then divider pages. And sort of the whole design had to be done and wrapped up July time.
How did your employer react to you having to take this on board? I'm sure they're thrilled
yeah,
that you
I mean,
got
they were absolutely
selected.
Thrilled that I got the opportunity. I mean,
that's Wolf Ollins, isn't it?
Yeah, Wolf Ollins. It's not every day a top legend designer comes and asks you to design like one of the most important you know, annuals. But obviously, you know, I had to take time off to do that. They were very good. They gave me like resourcing, and I had a design mentor to sort of help me along the process.
Yeah.
So that was absolutely fantastic that I wasn't sort of alone in the process, because as well as having the support of DNAD, I had the support of Wolf Hollands as well. So that was fantastic.
That was Fleur Isbell, designer of DNAD's 2013 annual, talking to our very own Ella John. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, note cards from Brooklyn-based Sesame Letterpress are not just beautifully designed, they're reminiscent of another time. Inspired by the tradition of letter writing, the small stationery company uses letterpresses from the 19th century to print cards, calendars and tags. Owner Breck Hostetter took Monocle on a tour of her studio to explain the process of letterpress printing, how she is preparing for the holidays and the joy of sitting down with an old handwritten note.
I have always had a love of paper and stationery, and just I love the tactile quality of letters and colors and imagery on paper, and sort of the keepsake quality of having something that you can tuck away in a book and hold on to. I went to art school in Boston and studied photography and printmaking and artist books, and really sort of explored the possibilities of adding imagery and type to paper and kind of playing around to see what you could do with that and making these like keepsake objects. And then I went on to do some book restoration and fine binding, and really kind of fell in love with the historical aspect of books and paper and book binding, and took a class in letterpress printing, and after that was it for me. I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the machinery, which are these just like beautiful, beautifully designed presses. We use mostly all presses from the 19th century. And I loved sort of the satisfying feeling of having a stack of paper, putting it into the press, and then after an hour or two of work, you have an amazing set of stationery or note cards or just beautiful prints to hold on to and keep. It's just so romantic, that idea that you could take something so old and heavy, such as a piece of cast iron machinery, and then put something so lightweight and clean and precious, like a beautiful piece of white cotton paper, and come up with something really wonderful at the end of it. We have about a dozen presses here, and they've all come to us through different ways. The first presses I got two presses at the same time about 14 or 15 years ago from a gentleman in Massachusetts who was retiring. He had been a printer his whole life. He had just been sort of like the town's printer. He printed police tickets, dry cleaning stubs, little packages for soldering tips, just really ordinary objects. And he had a couple of these presses in his basement, and he had been printing some tickets for a church pancake breakfast. And my father had picked up the tickets and discovered these printing presses and knew that I had just started getting interested in printing. Mr. Snow had been looking to sell these, so we went over and took a look at his basement, which was like a treasure trove of letterpress equipment and supplies, and picked out two presses. So those are the first two presses. But then we moved him down to Brooklyn and set up in a studio in the Dumbo neighborhood by the water here, and I've been renting them ever since. We do all letterpress printing here, so it's a very specialized type of printing. It's, you know, historically, this is how everything was printed. Books, any sort of notices that were going out, everything was printed letterpress. And, you know, the printing method involves taking raised type or imagery. Sometimes it's movable. Originally, it would be movable letters or a plate, and inking the raised surface and then pressing it against a sheet of paper so that the raised ink surface sort of bites into the piece of paper. Traditionally, letterpress printing would be flat and smooth. There'd be no indentation, no debossing. Because originally paper was expensive, people needed to print on both sides of the paper, and a debossed image would be very distracting to read. Nowadays, though, people really like that tactile quality, that three-dimensional element of seeing the type sink into their paper. And it's really one of the most recognizable characters of letterpress printing. And people want that. If they're going to pay for a more deluxe style of printing, they really want to feel it. So our presses really do specialize that. We have the plates, you know, we do all of our design digitally now. And then we have a polymer plate made, as opposed to using the movable lead type. That's sort of the 21st century aspect of what we do. But then we take the plate and we have all of our presses outfitted with these steel plates, so we can put our polymer plate on top of it and then take the process back 150 years and print with the old machinery. So our inked letters or logos get pressed into the paper. We print everything one sheet at a time by hand and one color at a time. So for printing something that's gray and navy, we'll ink up the press with a navy. We'll spend a good deal of time working on the registration, working on the saturation of the ink, making sure everything is clean and printing evenly, and then we start printing one card, two cards, three cards. When the print run is finished, then we clean the press and add the second color and then feed the second card in. We also print holiday cards. Sometimes people will, as opposed to where you'd order them online with your photo printed on them, we'll print these beautiful cards and people will attach the photos themselves. We also have a line of holiday cards that you can buy at gift shops. We do a lot of calendars for 2014, so we've been printing a lot of those, as well as some custom gift tags for people. We also are mixing in a few of the regular projects we do, like some bookmarks, save the dates for someone. We also print things for other small businesses. We print tags that get attached to candles or some paper that gets used to wrap around these beautiful line of soaps that a company uses. So we're kind of doing some quick soap wrap printing because they've been getting orders. It's been a really fun holiday season.
That's owner Breck Hostetter giving us a tour of her Sesame Letterpress. Coming up, we talk made in Italy and then we pop to Vienna for a Christmas market. But first, Stonehenge has traditionally been one of the most famous sites for visitors to the UK. But until now, its visitor centre has been one of the worst in Europe. Made up of a ramshackle cluster of porter cabins and portaloos, the centre sat by a popular motorway that ran right next to the famous stones. Now, after decades of arguments, the road has finally been closed and a new modernist structure has been built completely out of sight of the monument. We sent our reporter Hayley Ott along to the opening of the new centre to see if it succeeded in restoring some of the magic to Stonehenge.
Standing by the old entrance to Stonehenge, which, for the moment, is still in place, I'm essentially in a parking lot. The monument itself is just to my right, blocked from view by a porta cabin where people can buy a cup of coffee. Every few minutes, a new bus full of tourists drives up the A344 motorway, and people pour out to use the toilets, pay the entrance fee, and walk the few meters to the stones. As someone who grew up reading Thomas Hardy, this certainly isn't the experience I imagined for my first visit to the famous World Heritage Site. The views from the train up from London were more emotive than this. I head up from the stones in the old entrance, up the A344, towards the newly constructed Stonehenge Visitor Center. The porta cabin village and parking lot fade away in the distance behind me, and, apart from occasional passing tour buses, I'm left alone in the Salisbury Plain. It's only after I crest a hill that I can see the new center at all. According to English Heritage, the organization in charge of managing Stonehenge since 1984, this open, solitary experience is the point of the new center, construction on which, after decades of debate and £10 million, has finally finished. Lorraine Knowles, Stonehenge Director for English Heritage, spoke to me at the opening of the new space.
Well, we've been operating out of facilities that were built in 1968. And in 1968, there were about 200,000 visitors to the stones. Today, there are over a million. So we've been operating out of a small concrete bunker with porter cabins, with portaloos, and with an inadequate car park and shop, no exhibition, no cafe for people to sit down and have a cup of coffee. So it's been quite difficult, really, to give people a proper experience.
And why did it take so long to get sort of a new visitor centre project moving?
Well, the thing about Stonehenge is that there are so many people who have a stake in it. It's a very famous site. It's archaeologically very sensitive.
And so over the years, there have been various schemes proposed in different parts, and they have maybe not gone ahead because we haven't either got the consensus from all of the stakeholders or we haven't got the funding that we needed.
And what do you think the experience of Stonehenge that a visitor has should be?
Well, it should be evoking a sense of wonder that people built this monument thousands and thousands of years ago. I think there should be a sense of mystery. I think there always will be a sense of mystery associated with the stones, and a sense of admiration, really, and also giving people a pause, really, for reflection on the ingenuity and intelligence, really, of humankind to create such an astonishing monument thousands of years ago.
The new center rests gently on the grassy landscape. It might almost be floating. It has a rolling roof, lots of glass and open spaces, and delicate columns that make it resemble something organic. I asked Stephen Quinlan, who's a partner at the architecture firm Denton Corker Marshall, who designed the project, to explain his design choices.
We were saying that, you know, our principal job here was to be part of the process by which visitors who are coming in the 21st century have to go through a process of mental readjustment, so that when they're down at the monument, which is obviously all to do with timelessness and solidity and sort of spirituality, you know, we needed to be part of that process that got you from one to the other. And the design had to reflect that, had to fit into that kind of pattern of sort of readjustment, if you like. We had a number of sort of strategies. Obviously, it's a very challenging site because we're in the middle of a World Heritage site and in a field, basically, so there's nowhere to hide. So we were very keen to reduce the size of the building as much as possible. So we've taken all the ancillary accommodation out and put it in a separate structure. We were very keen to make it as much as possible an outdoor experience, because coming to the Stonehenge is an outdoor experience. So we made areas of the building, like the ticketing area and the sort of orientation area, outside.
Did you feel a sense of historical responsibility designing this building on this site?
Well, certainly, we were certainly, you know, because it is a national monument or international monument, I think, you know, the responsibility or the weight of a failure, if you like, weighed heavily on us from time to time. So I think, you know, to that extent, we were, you know, keen to get it right. Of course, you don't really know whether you've got it all right until it's over.
But the new visitor centre is also notable for being the first building with a contemporary design commissioned by English Heritage. Simon Thurley, Chief Executive of English Heritage, told me more.
Well, most of the buildings that we look after, and we look after over 400 sites and monuments in the National Heritage Collection, are medieval buildings, big stone castles or abbeys. And for most of those, we tend to build in timber, we tend to build in oak, quite heavy buildings. But this is in the middle of Salisbury Plain. This is in the middle of a huge open expanse of land with no buildings for miles around. And we felt to build something very heavy was quite wrong, and this building is deliberately light, it's airy. We felt incredibly strongly that our primary responsibility was to safeguard Stonehenge and its archaeology for the future, and that really fundamentally affected the design of the building, because a building needed to sit very lightly on the landscape. It's got no foundations, it's got no piles, the whole thing sits on a concrete raft, and we wanted it visually from a distance to appear light and transparent. And I think that's what we've achieved, and, you know, we're very pleased with the way it looks.
Hopefully, the newly designed centre will allow people to experience the Stonehenge of authors like Thomas Hardy, which is perhaps a heritage more fitting than the 1960s porta-cabins you used to meet on arrival at the site. Again, Stonehenge Director for English Heritage, Lorraine Knowles.
I think heritage is all about us understanding our place in time and our place in history. And the fact that human nature maybe doesn't change over the millennia, that the emotions that we experience today are emotions that our ancestors would have experienced. And I think heritage is about allowing people to just have a touch with that history, so that they can understand maybe where they sit in it.
For Monocle in Salisbury, I'm Hayley Joelle Ott.
After this short break, Monocle's David Pleasant will indulge his Italian roots and speak to the authors of a new book all about Italian architecture.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. The Made in Italy label, perhaps like no other, has become a brand in its own right. And very rightfully so. Since 1945, Italian design has commanded an increasing amount of attention from design journalists, critics, and consumers. And big names from the world of fashion, cars, and industrial design only illustrate this and continue to be some of the world's most desired man-made commodities. However, in some respects, the Made in Italy brand has led Italy to be a victim of its own success, a complacence that has perhaps led to the current malaise. Just out now is a book that hopes to investigate these themes. The title is Made in Italy, Rethinking a Century of Italian Design, and Monocle's David Pleasant met its editor Grace Lees Maffei to discuss how a country has come to be defined by its design output.
We're becoming more and more aware that design is a global phenomenon. It's always been global, silk trade routes, for example, onwards. But it really is time to reevaluate the usefulness of thinking about design in national terms when we have a global design world and global markets. A second reason why now is to do with the development of a critical design history. So we've been able to assemble an international group of leading scholars to critically analyse Italian design, and that relies on the maturation of my field, design history. And the third reason why now is to do with a sense that Italian design simply wasn't getting the level of critique that it deserved.
And that kind of leads me to my next question quite nicely. Reviews of this book, and yourself, you've mentioned that you feel that perhaps the Made in Italy concept or brand has perhaps led to Italy being kind of a victim of its own success, which is really unusual because obviously we like to hear success stories, and we immediately you'd think of Made in Italy as a fantastic phenomenon for Italy, a country that's now somewhat struggling in something of a malaise, has this fantastic heritage, certainly of design behind it. So explain why you think it's not such great news, perhaps.
Well, I think that Italian design is hidden in plain sight. It's ubiquitous in the media, and it is very rich because of I think you can posit a particularly Italian approach to design, which has poetic qualities, etc. And for that reason, it invites and deserves a properly critical approach. But because of its popularity, it's reported in a very praising way without the critical edge that I think it rises to beautifully.
So it's, you're wanting to criticise it, and then you kind of back it up as well within this book. So it's kind of putting this history on a plate and then letting it be open to the kind of critique that you feel other national design movements, other phenomenons have had. Do you think it's lacking? Is there a discrepancy between how we look at Italian design and, say, Scandinavian design or American or British design? Is that what?
I think that national approaches to design all warrant a level of questioning, particularly now for reasons I've explained. I think that where you approach a national body of design, you know, your default mode is to champion it and tell people why it's interesting. And certainly we believe that Italian design is very interesting, but we also think there are other questions you can ask about what, for example, really is Italian design. I mean, my chapter in the book says that Italian design is something best appreciated from outside Italy. So you can ask questions about what it is, whether it is truly distinctive, whether the category of Italian design is useful, and what Made in Italy actually means when Italy is home to such an international group of designers.
Maybe let's try and keep it simple and go back to that question, what is Italian design? And perhaps with some exponents of it, someone new to the topic, some of the great names, some of the examples of Italian design that perhaps are familiar, but we might not associate with Italy. I mean, maybe kind of list some of the things that you touch on in the book.
Mm. Well, if we take part one, which looks at actors or key players, we have Sott Sass, who we know, the designer of the Valentine typewriter, amongst many other things. But we also have the Harvard scholar Jeffrey Schnapp looking at Roberto Mango, who is not well known and doesn't have the credit that he deserves, really, because of his pivotal role in Italian design from 1950 to 1970 as a transatlantic bridge, looking to inform Italy about what US practitioners such as Buckminster Fuller were doing, and similarly providing a two-way street of information between the US and Italy. And then the third chapter in that first section looks at Thomas Maldonado, a key player in Italian design history, who was Argentinian and worked at Ulm. So you get a taste already of how you need to approach Italian design internationally.
And it's, you know, I think we're getting to what your, maybe the conclusion is, we've got to look beyond that kind of stereotyping. And I think it's easy for people to put, you know, like a red, white and green flag on something and perhaps a little cut and paste image of a Ferrari and then shape of the peninsula and there, hey presto, Italian design. But it's much more complex than that. And do you think that's, if we look at this book, that's kind of the main message?
That it's more complicated and that we need to dig deep to find more interesting and novel stories from Italian design history. So, you know, if you take the illustrations in our book, they'll present readers with things they haven't seen before, I'm sure.
If we kind of just look at that kind of that process, because you do, you put things in context throughout the book, your colleagues who you edited, who you gathered to produce the book, do you think there's some kind of, and I think that's one of the questions that's raised again and again in the book, is there some kind of Italian case or is there some Italian scenario that perhaps led to what we see as made in Italy, as Italian design? There are various reasons. I mean, you've mentioned there's a very helpful section at the beginning, kind of the history of Italian design in brief. And I have to say that's really useful for anyone wanting to know a little bit about it. One of the reasons, just to kind of get people going, is perhaps Italy industrialized a lot later than its rivals in Europe. Is that what other kind of reasons do you see?
Well, when I had the idea of producing a book on Italian design, I asked myself skeptically, why would we do that? What's significant about Italian design that justifies a book like that? And yes, it industrialised late, but you also have the city-state heritage, which has informed local networks as well as regional networks rather than national ones. So it's a country whose output and design practice is characterised by local areas of specialisation. Another reason is to do with the Catholic culture and the family importance in terms of manufacturing and design networks as well. So there are several cultural, social, economic contexts. Education is another. It's hard to build in Italy because the built environment is so historic and the contracts are tied up and sewn up in networks. So architecture graduates turn to design, which they're very able to do because they've had a particular theoretical education that's involved them in lateral thinking and questioning.
Wow, that's amazing. You can sum it up. Very complex themes. But that's interesting, that kind of deviation that has come from that overbuilt, over-cultured almost environment. That's fascinating. If we can just kind of finish off maybe and talk about where you see this book standing in kind of going forward. Can we kind of foresee how Italian design and the Made in Italy brand might take the country forward or bring it back or otherwise? Do you think there's if we kind of look to the future of Italian design, do you think we can learn anything from what you've found?
From the history, I think we can learn that national identities in design are complex and that you do need to look at a whole host of factors in order to understand them and evaluate them. But I think that the future of design in Italy is going to be performed in negotiation with increasing globalization. So the more design globalizes, the more important our local, regional and national identities in design become.
Yeah. And I mean, just one little example. I mean, it is really fascinating. The kind of preamble talks about, for instance, car design. How can you call an Italian car Italian when it's perhaps designed by who knows what nationality, perhaps in Italy, but then built somewhere else for a market that's in yet another country? That we think is new, but if we look at, there's a picture somewhere in here of a car in Cuba,
yes,
which is originally a Fiat model that was adapted by the Russians, sold in Cuba, driven, immensely popular in Cuba. So can we call that an Italian car or a Russian car or a Cuban car? Is this new? Is it? I mean,
No, it's not new, but it's becoming more pressing for us to consider. So our old categories about national identity and design really do need reevaluating because of the current situation. So yes, the complexity of national identity and design has a long history, but it's become more pressing to look into it right now. I mean, just to follow up on the automotive example that you give, another book that I've edited on iconic designs, 50 Stories About 50 Things, which is coming out next year, has a chapter by Thomas Brandt, who's written in this book. He's written about the Vespa in Made in Italy, and in iconic designs, he's looking at the tuk-tuk, which it sits on a Vespa, but has been modified all around the developing world for taxi travel.
Grace Lees Meffe, editor of Made in Italy, Rethinking a Century of Italian Design, speaking to our very own David Pleasant. Now, just in time for Christmas, we're going to close the show with a trip to the cold, crisp climes of Vienna. Clamorous Christmas markets selling traditional handicrafts are an indispensable part of Vienna at the time of Advent, and they're an absolute magnet for locals and tourists alike. But for those looking for something a tad more special, yet equally Christmassy, there are always festive design markets offering offbeat gifts that reflect the Austrian capital's rich tradition of design and manufacturing. Our Vienna correspondent Alexei Korolev went along to sample the goods.
There's a very holiday atmosphere here at the Design Schenken Market in uptown Vienna, with a huge Christmas tree over there laden with decorations and a scent of hot punch and gingerbread all around. Yet it's not your usual Christmas market. To begin with, it's indoors, spread over four stories of the Stilwerk Design Centre, and the type of stuff that's on sale here is not too traditional either.
My girlfriend is a jewellery designer.
Take Thomas and Anna here, for instance, offering something that seems to be edible, but I'm not so sure.
And we are selling fortune cookies made out of acrylic. Every one of these fortune cookies is handmade, and each piece is a unique piece.
And here's, for example, Celia selling tailor-made stationery.
And I'm selling notebooks that are handmade and from cover paper from Japan. And it's a nice combination because the writing paper is from Sweden. It's a premium quality paper and ecological paper. And the notebooks are binded together in a small book binder in Ungar, Budapest, Hungary. It's a very international project. Well, the creator is a French guy, but he's living in Vienna. And so, yeah, it's a mix of best from everywhere.
And here's Alessandro pursuing a somewhat similar line of business.
So we are based in Vienna. We print with an old machine from Leipzig. And actually now we are doing postcard and everything for Christmas.
Behind all this is a married couple, both of them designers, Karin Lebinger and Franz Maurer.
We did this project not for us. We don't need work, we don't need, there's not real, we don't earn money with this project, not real. We work very hard for this, Karin mostly, but I think it's very important, mostly for the young designers, to have the possibility to go on the market in a time where everybody wants to buy something, they have to buy something, it's Christmas.
That's exactly how Franz launched his own career.
Actually, I'm now, I don't know, 27 years, I have my own design office and I start on the Christmas market. Actually, I work very international, but my first money I earned on the Christmas market, I can realize other projects. And the people like to meet also the designer behind the products. That's very important. The real successful exhibitor here, they are the labels where the designers also on the market.
This seems to be true for Thomas and Anya, who are at their stall virtually all the time.
These fortune cookies, you can personalize them. So you can put your own takes, your own colors. So it is an individual gift you can buy. So yeah, we like it and we got very good feedback from our customers.
And of course, apart from a chit-chat with the designers, visitors to the market are also looking for uniqueness.
As every piece is unique, then you receive something something special for a present, so which is also not made in China or some.
It's again Celia at her Paper Republic stall. She highlights another big plus of her notebooks.
And it's not expensive. I think it's also very important to see that even though it's unique and special and the best materials and from everywhere, it's still affordable. It's also very important to recognize that design is not always expensive.
So is Vienna getting a Christmas rebranding, perhaps? Well, according to Karin Witesek, the head of the Stilwerk Design Center hosting the market, this mix of old and new has always been a feature of the Austrian capital.
When you look at the buildings, you have that mixture, and I think people like that mixture. So you have old-fashioned and conservative things at home, but then you just turn around the corner, and in the next room you have completely different type of design, of living area, with one piece that raises kind of tension to the old part of Vienna.
And Franz Maurer has some good proof of that.
Actually, our business publicum, they are mostly Viennese people, and they come every year. And most of them, they come not once time, they come two or three times. First look around, and then a second to buy, and then they forgot something and they come once again. Yeah.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei, and very Merry Christmas to you. And that's all we've got time for this special festive edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer, Aled, at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D in the new year. I'm playing you out a song close to my heart at this time of year. This is Elvis Presley with Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Thank you very much for listening. Happy Christmas. Bye-bye.